from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. If all goes as planned, as legislated, in July 2016, Vermont will be the first state in the country to require food that has been genetically modified to be labeled. Vermont's governor signed the labeling into law in May. But genetically modified crops are widespread in America. 90% or more of corn and cotton and soybeans planted in the U.S. last year were genetically modified. And labeling has been fiercely resisted. It will be again this hour on Point, GMO foods and labeling in America. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you want GMO foods to be labeled? Would you buy them if they were? Do we need them to feed ourselves, the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In May, here's the governor of Vermont, Peter Shumlin, signing the law that would make Vermont the first state to require labeling of foods with GMOs.
Vermonters have spoken loud and clear. They want to know what's in their food.
And off they go. Lawsuit already up on the rails against that. We'll talk a lot more about that in this hour by industry representatives who don't want that to go into effect. We'll hear in a moment from one of those who led the fight for GMO labeling in Vermont. But joining me first today from New York is Drake Bennett, staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. He wrote a big profile this week of Monsanto, the biggest GMO seed producer in the country. Drake Bennett, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got a couple of different perspectives on Monsanto here. On the cover of the magazine, there's people dancing around a beautiful ear of corn, says, "Don't hate me because I'm beautiful," sort of lauding GMO foods. Your headline inside says, "Inside Monsanto, America's third most hated company." Very deeply mixed feelings on this front, Drake.
That's right. And that's why we wanted to take a look at the company now. Monsanto is back in the news because of the labeling push, and it remains a deeply unpopular company. There's a Harris poll that came out earlier this year that looked at the reputations of the biggest companies in the world, and Monsanto is right at the bottom along with Halliburton and BP. So we wanted to look at, you know, what this company is actually doing right now and then let readers kind of hopefully decide what they think of it.
We're going to go to the law and labeling. Take us right out to the fields, the sort of cutting edge of where Monsanto has agriculture going. Take us right into the tractor cabin of Dustin Spears, if you would, on his farm in northern Illinois. You've got this great scene of him out there in the super high-tech agriculture zone. Describe some of that for us, Drake.
Well, I spent some time with Dustin. He's in northern Illinois, and he farms about 4,400 acres with his father-in-law, and it's mostly rented land, and it's spread all over northern Illinois. And I spent a couple days with him, and he really is using the full spectrum of the sort of latest tech, and a lot of that stuff comes from Monsanto. Some of it is the seeds that have been genetically engineered to do things like produce their own pesticides or be resistant to widely used herbicides, and they'll have a coating that gives them further protection. And these seeds are actually – they look sort of like M&Ms. They're bright green. They don't really look terribly natural. But the other part of it, and this is another thing that Monsanto is really pushing into, is stuff happening sort of in the cab of the tractor. We've all heard about big data. Some of us that write about technology are a little sick of the term. But farming really is this practice that benefits – that could benefit enormously from being able to take all this information about weather and pests and temperature and then crunch it and be able to give farmers recommendations about how to make better decisions. I mean, you hear the statistic a lot that farmers make 40 or 50 very important decisions over the course of a growing season. And what Monsanto and some of its competitors are really trying to do is take some of the guesswork out of that, you know, the same way we've used big data to change everything from, you know, retail logistics to dating. So
here's okay. Dustin in the cab of his tractor on moving across his 4,000 acres at a pretty good clip. He's got a 60-foot planter behind him, enormous. He's got a $47,000 sensor array on it that helps you, right, deposit each corn kernel at a depth of 2 inches, no matter how soft or hard the soil. Got a computer in there calculating the fertility of every sort of square meter of the field as he goes and adjusting fertilizer accordingly. He's updating his Twitter timeline, he says, like 1,000 times during the day because he's not driving. This is a self-driving tractor.
Right. I mean, I think what's going on here. And sort of the promise of genetic engineering has always been that to take a lot of the stuff that a farmer has to do for a seed and then just put it in the seed to turn, you know, nature into nurture in a sense, or nurture into nature in a sense. And this, I think, is really just another step in that process where knowledge that was sort of something a farmer knew now becomes something that is in software. And so just in the same way that we've sort of dumbed down, you know, flying an airplane or doing your taxes, I mean, there's a similar sort of process going on here. The promise is that it will make things, you know, safer and more efficient. But it, the sort of day-to-day, you spend time with a farmer, and at least in the planting, he's kind of just sitting there, and the technology is kind of doing a lot of the job for him.
But you also then moved into a protest against Monsanto. This happened to be in, what was it, Manhattan in March.
Exactly.
March against Monsanto. And give us a sense of the litany of complaints coming out of the protesters against Monsanto there.
Well, I think the biggest one really was if you sort of the people I talked to there were really worried about the safety of genetically modified foods, whether they should be eating this, whether they should be feeding it to their children. A lot of the people there were mothers, and a lot of them were mothers whose kids had medical conditions that mainstream medicine doesn't have particularly satisfactory explanations for, things like autism, ADHD, and they're convinced that it's something in the diet. So that's one big complaint. There's also this fear that this company, Monsanto, is just too powerful, that it's controlling our food supply, that it sues farmers for infringing the terms of the technology agreement they have to sign, that it has these sort of that it has people in Washington doing its bidding. Another complaint you hear a lot, or another fear, is this idea that Monsanto has developed technology that basically will render crops sterile so that farmers have to keep buying its seeds and can't save seeds, so-called the Terminator gene. This is actually not something Monsanto has ever sold or marketed and has promised not to do that, but it remains a very potent, I think, symbol in certain ways of what technology and a powerful company could potentially do to agriculture.
And then you take us to the Monsanto labs in Missouri, and where they came up with the first genetically modified seeds. There's some amazing stories coming out of there of all the research being done. Roundup, the big weed killer. This was news. I'd never read this before, and everything I've read about this, that they came up with Roundup, the weed killer, and then they came up with seeds that were with plants that wouldn't be killed by it. And those what were engineered from bacteria, you write, that grew in the chemical runoff from their own labs. It was just running off and running off and running off into the mud. And they found in that mud outside their labs bacteria that had become resistant to their own weed killer chemical.
That's exactly right. And in both cases,
it's kind of gross. Cool, but gross.
Right. I mean, it's nature at work. And, you know, the Monsanto had been making and selling Roundup for a while. They were having a really hard time coming up with a way to create a gene for resistance to Roundup.
So that you wouldn't have to be so careful how you spray. You could just spray it over the field. It wouldn't kill the crop. It would kill the weeds. And they do that now. Roundup Ready seeds for soybeans, corn, cotton, canola, alfalfa,
sugar beets, yeah.
You name it. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, the promise would be that it would greatly simplify a farmer's life because they could wait till the crops came up and then just spray the whole field and, you know, all the weeds would die and the crops would survive. So it would reduce the amount they would have to spray and the number of times they'd have to spray. And, you know, as you pointed out, the solution ended up kind of emerging from the muck outside one of their pesticide plants.
From chemical runoff. Oh, my gosh. Unbelievable.
Exactly. These bacteria over generations and generations, and obviously bacteria have very short generations, mm-hmm. had evolved a resistance to this stuff because only the ones that could survive being living their entire life doused in it would go on and replicate, reproduce. So that's where they ended up getting it.
They're still doing plenty of GMO work, but they're also using traditional, though hyper-fast, kind of crop manipulation, seed manipulation, Mendelsohn style.
Exactly. This is the same stuff that Gregor Mendel practiced in his monastery garden, you know, in the 19th century. It's just done at sort of this incredible speed and technological complexity. I mean, one thing that I learned in doing the research for this story is that a lot of the research at Monsanto, it really isn't even in genetic modification. I mean, you know, roughly 50% of their research budget has traditionally gone to that. But there's a lot of stuff that they get into their seeds through traditional breeding, you know, this old-fashioned process. But what they've been trying to do constantly is figure out how to make that process much faster. So now it's this very futuristic process involving robots and lasers and gene sequencers and these kind of crazy devices that they create in this fabrication facility in the basement of their lab.
But still, they're fiercely, fiercely defensive about GMOs. They will defend it all the way. Why? Why do they see it as so important?
Well, they invest a lot of money in bringing, you know, for each trait, each sort of characteristic that they get into a seed and bring to market. The estimate is that it takes 10 years for, you know, it's a very labor and money intensive process to do the research and then to clear the various regulatory hurdles. So 10 years and about $100 million per trait. That's a big investment. And they make a lot of money off of this. I mean, it's about $40 premium per acre for a GMO seed over a non-GMO seed. It's an inexact comparison, but it's about that. So there's a lot of money there, and they don't want to lose that because of farmers basically replanting these seeds.
May last year, protesters gathering in Federal Plaza in Chicago as part of a global march against Monsanto rally there against genetically modified organisms, GMOs. We're talking about GMO labeling in America this hour. It's the law now in Vermont. It's headed for a vote in Oregon. Just last week, they turned in the petitions with more than enough signatures, they think, to put it on the ballot in November. Big battles still ahead, and we're looking at what we should know, what we will know, about the genetics of the food we eat. You heard the protests right there. Drake Bennett writes about Monsanto in his big story, Inside Monsanto, America's Third Most Hated Company, for Bloomberg Businessweek, joins us from New York. Monsanto has plenty to say about all this, and it's all positive, of course. Here's a 2010 television ad from Monsanto, the world's largest producer of genetically modified seeds.
We're committed to helping farmers double yields by 2030. With modern advances in breeding and industry-leading tools that play an important role in bringing improved performance to your fields. With new innovative biotechnology traits, featuring the most advanced and future pipeline of traits from the Genuity brand, like first-generation drought-tolerant corn.
Monsanto's ad, "Don't hate us because we're beautiful," says the cover story Drake Bennett wrote for Bloomberg Businessweek. In May, on the Vermont State House steps, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin signed a law that would make Vermont the first state in the union to require labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms. Shumlin said Vermont was joining 60 other countries that require labeling.
We in this state today will sign the first bill in America, joining 60 other countries, where Vermonters will have the right to know what's in their food.
Yay!
And just last week in Salem, Oregon, Julia DeGraw, organizer for Food and Water Watch in Oregon, spoke at a rally in support of GMO labeling there. She spoke on the same day that they delivered signatures to qualify a GMO labeling vote on the November ballot.
And not enough information about whether or not these things really are safe for our families. And if we don't know, don't we have a right to know whether or not we're choosing to ingest these things and feed them to our kids?
Drake Bennett has written all about Monsanto. Big story in Bloomberg Businessweek. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Really a terrific piece of reporting. We're going to hear in a moment from a horticulturalist about the science here. Let's go right to the public push for GMO labeling. Falco Schilling is with us from Montpelier, Vermont. An attorney, consumer protection advocate for VPIRG, Vermont Public Interest Research Group. They supported and backed the Vermont law that makes it mandatory to label GMO foods. Falco Schilling in Vermont, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
First of all, we'll talk about the roadblocks that may be between here and there. There are plenty legal challenges. But what does the law say, Falco? What is coming to Vermont, all things otherwise equal, in the summer of 2016?
Well, essentially what the law says is that if you're going to go to a retail outlet like a supermarket and you're looking at the store shelves and you see a packaged food that's that might have genetically engineered ingredients in it, it's going to say produced with genetic engineering. Similarly, if you walk down the aisle where there's fresh fruits and vegetables, though there are few fresh fruits and vegetables at this point that are genetically engineered, if they are, I would have to say so, and you'd be able to make an informed decision.
And does it apply to all food or only packaged foods? What?
It applies to all foods, including raw agricultural products.
So milk, meat?
Well, milk and meat, if they were to be coming from an animal that was itself genetically engineered, like a salmon, which is something that we might be seeing coming on the market soon, that would have to be labeled. But if it's not itself genetically engineered, that doesn't have to be labeled.
What do you think are the implications? If Vermont moves ahead with this, what are the implications for the rest of the country, Falco, if any?
Well, I think it definitely is going to have some implications, and what we'd really like to see, ideally, is some sort of federal labeling system. That's what I think we want here in Vermont and what a number of people around the country. In fact, 90% of Americans, as polled by the New York Times, say they want to see genetically engineered foods labeled. But what we're doing here in Vermont is we're saying we have a right as a state to provide this information to our consumers. Our consumers are demanding it for a number of reasons, and therefore we're going to uphold what they're asking for and give them this information.
Now, when President Obama campaigned for the presidency in Iowa, he talked about exactly that, having the FDA, I think, act to bring in GMO labeling. Has he moved on that at all? Has the federal government moved toward this? Or under industry pressure and maybe more, have they moved away from it?
If anything, I'd say we've seen nothing but gridlock on this issue down in Washington. Even right now, there's competing bills in Congress, one that would say we need to label all genetically engineered foods, and then another that says, look, let's prohibit the states from passing any laws around this, and let's make all labeling voluntary. So it is definitely a hot button issue down in Washington, but we're seeing that there is major inaction down there, and that's part of the reason that states all across the country have taken up this issue and are moving forward with it, both here in Vermont and in Washington before that, California before that, and now Oregon coming up this fall.
You say moving forward with it, but in a number of states, this has been raised and failed, California included, under fierce pushback from the food and agriculture industry.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. The pushback against this law came from one of the most well-funded campaigns in ballot history out in California. There was about $45 million spent trying to defeat that ballot initiative, and it failed narrowly. And part of that is the politics of a ballot initiative campaign, where you can just tell people, look, you might want to know what's in your food, but this isn't the right way to do it. It's a little different here in Vermont when we work through the legislative process. So this is something that we've been talking about with our legislators for the last 3 years, looking at different aspects of the bill and making sure we dive deep and hear from all sides on the issue and have the time to craft a bill that we think really addresses the interests of the state.
Drake Bennett in New York, if Vermont moves ahead with this, if other states begin to do the same, what does the food industry say would be the implications? Will we have two sets of shelves, one with GMO products, or would they be side by side, or would this push GMOs out if the consumer started to say no thank you?
Well, I think nobody exactly knows. I mean, what Monsanto will say is that this is going to make farming much more expensive because of the expense of keeping GMO and non-GMO crops and separate. That you have to sort of keep the harvester, you have to clean it so that there's not a single grain of GMO corn left there before you use it on non-GMO corn. Interestingly, though, when you talk to executives at Monsanto, you know, up to the CEO, Hugh Grant, when I asked him about this, he basically said that he could live with a federal labeling regime. What he really doesn't want is a sort of patchwork of different state labeling requirements that would require them to have, you know, something in Vermont and then something different in Ohio. So that does seem to be, at least in theory, a point of agreement between people who are very pro-labeling and Monsanto,
when Monsanto's CEO says that, what does he mean? That they think they could persuade Americans that GMO foods are all right? Or would we go the Europe path where there's actually very little relatively consumed there because people have just turned against it?
That's right. I mean, I think one point to make about Europe is that when they put in place their labeling regime in 1997, their original labeling regime, these technologies were really only beginning to come into the market. And so they really barely existed in Europe. We'd be going from a point where, as you pointed out earlier in the program, you know, 90% or more of the corn, cotton, and soybeans that are planted in the United States are genetically modified at this point. So Europe is a bit of an inexact comparison. But I think, interestingly, in some countries in Europe, and GMOs are legal to cultivate in five countries in Europe, you do see some increasing acceptance in some polls to the idea of buying this stuff and consuming it over the past few years.
I want to begin to hear from our listeners. Melissa is calling from Austin, Texas. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air. What do you think?
I totally I'm against genetically modified food, and I think that it should be labeled. It really should be. I mean, this is about food control. I really think it is. And I think it's so important that people are allowed to make the choice also. I think that's a really big issue.
Melissa, why are you against it? I mean, the companies who make it say it's safe, it makes food cheaper, more abundant, it helps us, we'll be able to adapt foods to deal with climate change, all kinds of positives. Why do you say no thanks?
I just think that I just see too many issues with a lot of allergies coming, like the celiac. The wheat's different. The genetically modified wheat is not the same wheat that we are forefathers have been eating, and I noticed that people are getting these intolerances to this new wheat.
We're going
to
look at this.
Sure it has to do with this.
We're going to look at the science of all this. I appreciate your call from Austin, Melissa. To be clear, Drake, is wheat genetically modified or not? I know corn and soybeans are. I haven't seen wheat listed.
No, not in the United States.
So,
yeah.
But you hear the kind of popular impression that everything's modified now. Melissa, thanks for your call. Raymond in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Raymond, you're on.
Yes, once again, thank you, Vermont, for taking the lead on this. And by the way, what is wrong with people having a choice on what they want to buy and to put in their bodies? If Monsanto thinks that their product is so great and they have these great advertisements, why are they so uptight about it being labeled? You know, of what it really is. The organic products have things labeled. And let's take it a step further. You know, if Monsanto is not really winning on this, which obviously it's touch and go, why don't they go organic? They have the money and technology. They could be in the lead. What's the problem here, Monsanto?
We will look at that, Raymond. I appreciate your call as well. Drake, is that you?
Yeah, Monsanto actually does sell a lot of conventional seeds that you could use to farm organically. So, I mean, not everything they sell is actually genetically modified.
But it's hardly their main thrust, right? I mean,
it's hardly where they make most of their money either.
Falco, what about this issue? If they're so proud of their stuff, why not label it? You've passed this law. It's signed into law in Vermont, but you've got four national organizations who've already filed a legal challenge to the law in U.S. District Court in Burlington, Vermont, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, the International Dairy Foods Association, the National Association of Manufacturers. They're mounting a serious legal challenge here. What's their argument legally, Falco?
Well, I first want to say that I think Raymond really echoes a lot of the comments we heard while talking to folks about this campaign that say, look, if these products are so great, then you should be able to put a label on it and be proud of it. And that's something that I think we agree with. When it comes down to the legal arguments, one of the main arguments that these companies are making is that they have a First Amendment right to keep consumers in the dark about what's in their food, that they're saying the state of Vermont shouldn't have the ability to require them to put this information on their package.
I mean, free speech also means free not to speak, not to be forced to say something.
It's a doctrine called compelled commercial speech. I won't go into too much further, but that's really the main idea. They also talk about some of the other issues having to do with federal preemption and also the Commerce Clause, but I think really this case is largely going to be fought over the First Amendment issue.
They've got deep pockets here. As Drake said, they came out millions and millions in California. Vermont's so worried about this legal fight, they've started a website, foodfightfundvt.org, to raise money from ordinary citizens online to fight it. Do you have deep enough pockets to take on and win the legal eagles of the food and ag industry, Falco?
Well, I think that we have a strong enough law that we can win on this one. And I also want to say that I think the Food Fight Fund was a very interesting idea, and a lot of that came out of genuine Vermonters who would come up to legislators who'd say, I'm too concerned about the price of this law, what it's going to do. And they said, look, I want to be able to donate my money. I want to be able to help support this. and make sure this law goes into effect. So really, the legislators were responding to what they heard from their constituents, that they wanted to have an opportunity, even if they were going to have to take on a large court battle, to make sure that they had this information on their food so they can make informed decisions.
A couple more callers right here from Vermont. Tom in Richland, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the program. My question is, how well do we do when we engineer nature? In a movie called GML Roulette, gene splicing turns out to be something that sounds scientific but is imprecise and random. It's a process that creates millions of other combinations, right, that create our Franken-food and Franken-life. Those random combinations of chromosomes are aberrant to nature.
Start gene splicing and you don't know where you'll end up, you say, Tom. Let me hold that thought and get one more, if I may. Appreciate your call. Steve in Windham, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. There's no science, and I know Vermont really doesn't like Monsanto. It's like a fear-based legislation. The only scientific study was a fructose study injecting rats in France, injecting them with corn syrup. Now, if I grow tomatoes in my backyard using the Mendelssohn genetically modified way, will my Mendelssohn brand new tomato plants never seen on Earth, are they going to be labeled GMOs except the old-fashioned way? And there's this anti-European tinge that goes back. The Europeans have hated Americans because we have the technological advantage on the world. This I don't own stock in Monsanto. I don't work for them. But I can see this anti-Americanism coming out of Europe.
When they say no thank you to GMO products. Steve, let us look at the science here. Tom raises it. You raise it. Kevin Folta joins us right now from Gainesville, Florida, professor of horticultural science, chairman of the Horticultural Science Department at the University of Florida, PhD in molecular biology. Kevin Folta, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
We want to ask you about the science of genetically modified crops. And so these days we should ask you before we even start, is your research funded by Monsanto? Do you have any financial ties whatsoever to the ag and seed production industry?
No, I don't have any funding from Monsanto. And even if I did, it wouldn't cloud my interpretation of scientific data. This is an integrity found amongst public scientists that really makes those kind of claims kind of insulting. We work for you.
Good, but we've learned we have to ask. There's a lot of industry-funded science going on out there. Mm-hmm. So when you look at GMO products, do you see danger? Do you see safety? Do you see both?
Well, what I see is 18 years of safe and effective use of the products that you mentioned. There's never been a single health related issue that's been directly connected to a GM crop. There are certainly limitations like the production of resistant weeds and insects, and that's something that we need to keep an eye on.
You mean that emerge in response to the genetically modified crops?
Well, the overuse of specific herbicides and the presence of a single type of insect resistance. But the biggest thing that I see is lost opportunity. I think there are so many ways that public scientists like me could implement this kind of technology to help the environment, to help farmers, help the developing world.
Well, you mean lost opportunity if it's labeled? You think that creates...
Well, the labeling is part of a spectrum of fear-related decisions. There are crops that we could grow that we could do so much with, but they're arrested because of the high cost of deregulation and the public pushback, which causes industries to not want to adopt these technologies. And it allows the big companies, like the Monsantos and the BASFs, for them to be able to do this, but guys like me can't.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about GMO labeling in America. It's the law now in Vermont. As of this spring, it's headed for a vote in Oregon as of last week. Big battles still ahead, looking at what we should know, what we will know about the genetics of the food we eat. Kevin Folta is with us, chairman of the Horticultural Science Department at the University of Florida. Falco Schilling is here. He's consumer protection advocate for VPIRG, Vermont Public Interest Research Group. They were in the middle of the fight to make this the law in Vermont. They've done that, passed by the legislature there, signed by the governor. Legal challenges still ahead. Drake Bennett is with us from Bloomberg Businessweek, been writing in great detail about Monsanto, its aspirations, its ambitions, its research, and its seeds. A couple of responses on Facebook here, lots online, but here Jeff says, why not give the choice to the consumer? Why not simply label GMOs? What's the problem with food transparency? Then Kay writes, ooh, science is so scary. Might as well report that GMOs kill kittens. How else do we feed an overpopulating earth until there's better technology? Should we install whole foods all over Africa or other countries suffering from famine, drought? Seriously, she says, talk about sensationalism. This show has it in droves. Well, we're trying to look at all sides of this. Becky in Dixon, Tennessee. Becky, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is real simple. I just feel like this is basic consumer protection. We people, humans, do not have a choice. We have to eat. Because we have to eat, we can make a choice about the types of foods we want to eat. But our staples, our fruits, our vegetables, our grains, I mean, we don't have a choice. And I feel like this is just a simple case of consumer protection, and we should have that choice. We can't live without food.
Yeah.
So I feel like we need to be, you know, you can talk about it scientifically and the effects, but I don't want to be a guinea pig. I don't think that our children should be guinea pigs. I mean, it's just not fair.
Becky, we've got it. Just let you be informed. Kevin Folta, you're the scientist here. There's the argument, and we heard it on Facebook as well, for transparency. I mean, why not put the label on and let people decide for themselves as scientists put out their findings and all the rest?
Well, labels are important when there's something important to learn about the product and there's something important to know. But your caller frames it very well, that she wants protection. And earlier, you know, like Melissa earlier said that she's afraid of GMO wheat causing allergies when there is no GMO wheat. Tim said that there was chromosome aberrations that we just don't understand. We understand extremely well the genetic changes that occur and can tell you a lot about the type of genetic events that are there. So what we have is a tremendous amount of misinformation and misunderstanding, which causes fear in people who then feel like guinea pigs. But if you take the time to look at the science and understand how it works, it's really not very scary.
Falco Schilling, what about it? Our listener Kay says this is sensationalism and that the science should be comforting, not frightening.
Well, I think really that Becky kind of echoes how we feel about this issue. It's a simple issue of letting people make informed decisions about what they eat. We aren't making judgments about what farmers can grow or what can actually be put into the food. We're just letting consumers make decisions.
But what about the science? I mean, Kevin says there's no evidence of a problem here. Shouldn't that matter?
It does matter, and that's something that the Vermont legislature definitely took into account while looking at this legislation. I mean, they spent multiple months looking at this issue, and one of the things that they found was that there was science on both sides saying that there could be potential harms, and then there's also science that saying that these products are beneficial, and in that situation, and based off a number of other legitimate state interests, it makes sense to do the prudent thing and just label these foods.
Put the label out there. A little transparency, please. Bill in Austin, Texas. Bill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I just been listening, and I know I've heard, you know, some comments about, you know, the science being bad and good. I haven't heard us talk about the fact that, you know, if you're growing, you've got a farmer growing organic soybeans, and then the guy two acres down is growing this genetically modified stuff. So the organic farmer is getting contaminated, and you know, there's no prevention of that, and then, you know, he's getting sued because he's now selling Monsanto type soybeans that are coming out of
yeah.
organic products. So that's one piece. The other piece is just with this genetically modified stuff, you're basically dealing with monocultures, so you're dealing with one particular strain of soybeans or one particular strain of cotton or canola. And that's just not how the earth has evolved. You know, we've had all these, I don't know what to call them, heirloom varieties, like you have them of tomatoes
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And so all those are being kind of not cultivated in favor of these monocultures that are then susceptible to one particular pathogen, and then it wipes out the entire deal.
Let 1,000 varieties bloom, you say, Bill. Let us look at that. Drake, a couple things there. Is Monsanto indeed suing that kind of organic farmer who gets the genetic modified stuff into his or her crop? And what about the monoculture worry that Bill expresses in Austin, Drake?
Well, I'll address the lawsuit issue. Mm-hmm. Monsanto says that they've never sued farmers, organic or conventional, for having their crops cross-pollinated accidentally by mm-hmm. neighbors. Yeah.
And, though they and have sued found, people for using their seeds in ways they don't like.
Sure. No, that's certainly true. They have sued farmers. What they will say, and I certainly didn't find anything in court records to dispute this, was that they go after farmers who are intentionally trying to get the advantages of this technology without paying for it. Because mm-hmm. there are for farmers real advantages to this in terms of yield, in terms of having to do less work. I don't know if Dr. Folta would be better to address the monoculture issue. But
sure, we'll take it to Kevin. Kevin, what about you hear Bill's concern that if we've got these modified seeds sold in great volumes, you get a monoculture, you're vulnerable in that way.
Well, it does tie in with the idea that that Drake's brought up earlier, that Monsanto has been working with traditional breeding at a breakneck pace. The addition of biotech traits to backgrounds, a given plant background, start with a foundational hybrid that's extremely strong and an extremely good plant. To get that, we've had to incorporate – well, we, meaning the larger science we – has incorporated genetics from really diverse types of plants, bringing in new types of genetics from plants that maybe were considered reasonably useless years ago. Now we can have actually, if you look across crops, you have a tremendously enhanced genetic diversity, which is coming from the incorporation of these traits from lines not traditionally used.
Let's go to Don in Whetstone, Kentucky. Don, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering to has there been any resolution as to whether or not these GMO crops are having a negative effect on the honeybee population?
Been a lot of concern about that, and we've seen it come up. Drake, it came up in your reporting.
Right. So the short answer is no, that's not resolved. There seems to be an emerging consensus, however, that a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids are contributing to colony collapse in honeybees. That's actually not a pesticide that Monsanto makes. It does incorporate it into some of its seed coating, some of its seed treatments, but it's not really a genetically engineered technology.
But is it related to or used in conjunction with GMO seeds?
Sure, and conventional seeds as well.
Kevin Folta, what about the honeybee problems and genetic engineering of crops?
It's actually a common allegation, although when you look at the literature through probably about 100 good feeding studies of bees with the insecticides generated by GM crops, there is no association that's shown between these crops and bees.
Josh in Des Moines, Iowa. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to say that as far as the labeling goes, and full disclosure, I am an employee for Monsanto.
Okay.
But when we look at nutritional labeling, we really should be looking at what's the differences for the consumer. So if we want to label something, we want to look at things that really have a nutritional difference. And as far as genetically modified things go, there isn't a difference there. So we aren't looking at something that nutritionally is going to change for the consumer. And if we start getting into labeling everything on there, what's to say the next thing will be another thing that's not substantially equivalent as far as things go.
Print the full genetic code there. But Josh, what if people want to know? What if consumers, Vermont citizens, simply want to know, and they've said so in law?
So if they want to know, there's actually labeling that you can do. So if you want to be a producer of food right now, you can label your products GMO-free. If that is the market you're wanting to target. What we're talking about is the other large grocery producer companies that don't want to have that extra regulation and burden for those people that don't feel the need for that label. And really, as far as safety goes, that's where our requirements and regulations should be centered around.
Josh, you work for Monsanto. Do you think it would make food more expensive if we had GMO labeling?
I think especially if we're looking at a patchwork right now where different states are going to have different laws, there's definitely an added cost for grocers if they're trying to comply to make sure that they follow the different regulations if they sell in multiple states. I really do think that there'd be an added cost. And in the end, I think that consumers really would be losing out on a bigger production standard that can lower the cost on the general side.
And yet
not just the cost from the labeling,
yeah,
but the cost from the loss of choice for the producers, because at some point it will be treated almost like the RBST on milk was, where producers will choose just to say, hey, I can see a small premium in the market, and I'm just going to go that way, whether or not the science supports that.
Yeah, and that already happening. I mean, I'm looking here at Ben & Jerry's. Of course, they're owned by Unilever now. Unilever put a lot of money into defeating California's GMO labeling initiative. But Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream manufacturer in Vermont, they are trying to go GMO-free just as fast as they can. Already market pressure out there on looking here at Cheerios and some other cereals where they may not be fully GMO-free, but they're trying and they're bragging on that because they care about consumer response. Josh, I appreciate your call in Des Moines. Let's go back to Vermont where the pot's being stirred here. Hinesburg, Vermont. David is calling. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. So what I wanted to comment about, I'm a state senator in Vermont and helped lead the way to pass this legislation. And in some of the comments that have been made, I think there's counter comments to them. One of them was that there have been no health impacts from people eating this.
Is this David Zuckerman, the lead sponsor on the GMO labeling bill, calling?
Yes, that's me. Hello.
Senator Zuckerman from Vermont. All right. Okay. So what about it? What's your reaction?
Well, there are a couple comments made, for instance, that there are no health impacts for people eating this over the last 18 years, but there's actually no way of knowing that, no way of tracing it, because there is no labeling. So we don't really know that there have been no health impacts. I would also add that there was a discussion that this would cost more to consumers or producers if it was labeled, and that's also not true. The industry study that said it would cost more that they used in California to help persuade the public against it was that people would pay $400 more for their food, but that's only if those people choose to change their buying habits. There's nothing in this law that requires people to change their buying habits, and that was if people were going to buy all organic instead of the labeled or GMO food. And so a lot of the arguments that are made, I think, ultimately aren't really solid in terms of why this would be a bad idea.
Senator Zuckerman, USA Today came up to your neck of the woods in Vermont, and they talked with you. You farm up there, organic farmer. They also talked with Bill Rowell at Green Mountain Dairy in Sheldon, Vermont, and who uses plenty of GMO crops, big operation there. Neat as a pin, the USA Today reports. But Rowell said, you can't base your society to a large extent on science and then ignore it when it doesn't suit you. What do you say to that, Senator Zuckerman?
Sure. Well, there are some studies that raise questions in terms of animal consumption of GMOs and potential health impacts. There also, it's very clear, for instance, in Tennessee, that there are resistant weeds to now Roundup and others, and they're going to be using stronger chemicals. We base our law on the fact that there's questions about the science. We agree it's not conclusive one way or the other. And we also base it on the fact that there are environmental concerns because now that stronger chemicals are going to have to be used to kill those weeds, there'll be greater environmental impact. Those are the basis that give us some legal defense with respect to the free speech discussion you mentioned earlier and gives us a state interest in allowing us to require this labeling.
What do you think are the chances that you will fend off the big industry lawsuit against this law, Senator?
Well, I think we've got a reasonable chance. Of course, with five lawyers, we'll get five different opinions. But I do think we've crafted the law in a way that meets the environmental and health question about free speech. And we have a reasonable chance to win.
Vermont State Senator David Zuckerman, and organic farmer and lead sponsor of the bill, calling in there. Thanks very much for calling, David. Nice to hear from you. Drake Bennett, what does Monsanto say if this goes through in Vermont? Let's say Oregon votes it in. If it starts to proliferate at the states or the federal level, what does Monsanto say will be the consequences for what gets planted, what gets produced in terms of food in this country?
Well, I think they do talk about it costing more. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of the corn and soy grown in this country, the vast majority of which is genetically modified, doesn't go to feed people. It actually goes to feed animals and it goes to fuel ethanol. So even if we had a wholesale rejection of GMOs on the part of the American supermarket consumer, you'd still have this very large market for these things. So I think they take perhaps some comfort in that. But again, as I mentioned earlier, I think you are seeing some resignation on the part of some of the leadership there to the idea of labeling. They just really would prefer it be federal rather than state by state.
Kevin Fulta, if the country turns against GMOs, how do you see the opportunity cost? Many people for that. What would it cost us?
Well, I think the biggest problem is a continued stigma of good science, that we'll be actually vilifying a technology which has done wonderful things for farmers, has been incredibly important for the environment in terms of cutting insecticide use, which has been massive, and limits what technologies we may employ in the future. It continually raises the bar for bringing new useful crops to the consumers.
And Falco Schilling, last word goes to you. Are you confident that you'll have this label on Vermont food in summer of 2016?
I am confident. After seeing the hard work done by the Vermont legislature and everything that went into it, and the strong legal team that's being assembled here in Vermont to stand up for Vermonters' interests, I think we're going to be seeing labels on supermarket shelves in 2016.
Are we going to need GMOs to deal with climate change and hunger in a huge global population in this century, Falco?
Well, I think that they might end up being a tool, but labeling them gives consumers a choice about whether they want to eat them, and that's really what our law is all about.
Falco Schilling, attorney with Consumer Protection Advocate, a Vermont Public Interest Research Group, who worked to get the law passed, joining us there from Montpelier, Vermont. Falco, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Folta, chairman of the Horticultural Science Department at the University of Florida. Professor Folta, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Drake Bennett, who wrote a terrific story for Bloomberg Businessweek on Monsanto. Check out, you can link to it through our website, onpointradio.org. Drake in New York, thanks so much for your reporting and your time, Drake.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls, comments, aplenty today. Always appreciate that. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.